Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is a very important part of our ability to participate in, let alone prevail in, that war that revolves around something that many of us, I think, take for granted, namely love of our country and a recognition of its extraordinary qualities and the imperative of defending them against, as the oath many of us have taken says, all enemies, foreign and domestic. A woman who has recently performed an important piece of research into the phenomenon of patriotism, a shorthand way of describing all of that, I think, is with us, I'm very pleased to say, for two segments. She is Anne Sorok. She is the president of the Frontier Lab and has also become the executive director of a new initiative, the Ear to the Ground Project. And we're going to talk in a moment about its first product, which is a drill down involving extensive public policy research about patriotism. But before we do that, I wanted to welcome Anne, of course, and thank her for the work that she's done in the past, which involves some extraordinarily interesting and important studies of popular sentiment, mass movements, what prompts people to become engaged in things like, Black Lives Matter, the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, protest against Governor Scott Walker, and much more. She has previously worked for United States Senator Paul Fitzgerald and a dear friend and much admired inspiration to many of us, Congressman Henry Hyde. Thank you, Anne, so much for joining us and for this extraordinarily interesting project, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment.
Well, it's an honor to be here with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think before we get to the study that you've done on patriotism and partnership with the American Culture and Faith Institute, I'd just like to give you a moment to talk a little bit about your background. You really seem to bring some interesting and perhaps extraordinarily needed skill sets as a market researcher, focusing, as I say, on some of these phenomena that increasingly seem to be shaping our posture in what I think of as the war for the free world. Give us a little of your background.
Well, I think like many of us, I came to D.C. hoping to change the world, help the country, and I had a wonderful experience being able to work for two amazing leaders, Henry Hyde, who I happened to be working for during the impeachment. Got a very interesting view of all of that.
You know, real civics lesson, wasn't it?
Yes, you know, I like to tell people, I used to watch him, he would read Cicero as he prepared to go into that trial every day. And I just wonder today how people would view that now that the left has changed their tune a little bit about sexual harassment. But in any case, I spent some time on the Hill. I spent some time in publishing at Regnery Publishing. And then like many people in DC, I felt like I wanted to go be part of what I was talking about, which is that free market private sector. So I went back to school, got my MBA, worked in the private sector, and the most I worked on Manwich, branding Manwich, the Sloppy Joe mix, and I use that almost every day now as I try to market our ideas.
Marketing ideas, no kidding. Well, listen, one of the ideas that you are marketing at the moment is this Ear to the Ground project. Tell us a little bit about it. Who's involved, and what is your goal?
Well, I'm so excited. This is the launch for Ear to the Ground today. It is a wonderful collaboration of a unique set of researchers, public policy people, academics, and grassroots activists who are uniquely committed, I think, in this day and age to a different posture towards listening to the American people. That is our overriding ethic. We are using market research as a tool to bring the voice of the American people to a larger audience. It's why we are launching as our first project today, this study on patriotism. It's very in-depth, very thorough. But the idea is to bring people from all their different silos, not just in DC, but around the country, and say, what are the new issues animating Americans? What have we not been paying attention to that really matters to them with our sort of one-off polls or polling generated just to influence them? So we're not looking to control or influence the American people. We're looking to listen.
A fascinating thought, and one that you'd like to think more people in Washington were doing. I mean, it is, after all, supposed to be a representative government we've got, but it does seem, especially at moments like this, Ansarok, when the Congress seems poised to plunge into some end-of-the-year Christmas presents for illegal aliens, for example, that I think the public has not, in fact, been heard very clearly, despite the votes that they cast in the last election, very much to the contrary. So the Ear to the Ground initiative is going to be addressing, as I understand it, the why driving American opinions and attitudes and behavior. And I think in that regard, it's very, very important that you took as your first project, your first initiative, this undertaking to assess American views on patriotism. And you did this in collaboration with Dr. George Barna and his American Culture and Faith Institute. Tell us a little bit of the backstory on how you chose to address this particular topic first and foremost, and we'll get into some of your findings.
Yeah, we wanted to look at a theme in America that was overarching and underarching in a way, many of the other issues that people may have divergent points of view on. So during the more recent elections, we had seen aspects of patriotism and nationalism, which are maybe not exactly the same thing, come to bear. But we had also seen sort of these very evocative protest movements where the idea of the flag was up in the air. And what does it mean to protest? And are Americans still in agreement on all these things? You know, it's something as we look at 2018 that we want to understand, where is our nation united, even on this most fundamental idea that we can stand for an America that means something that to all of us as citizens.
And again, this was sort of showcased recently by the intense controversy between President Trump, I guess, primarily on the one hand, and the National Football League on the other, and this idea of football players taking a knee during the national anthem. And this was seen by many of us as distinctly unpatriotic. There were some who were arguing that, oh, no, this is an expression of a different kind of patriotism. And I guess that's really the finding that seems to jump out from your first project at the Ear to the Ground initiative, Ansarok, and that is that there are evidently two distinct kinds of patriotism in America today. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, and you highlighted one of these issues that I think has really captured the public's attention and made us all think about how do we feel about freedom of speech. And we did find there appears to be two completely divergent ways people are thinking about patriotism and how they're defining and even how they see themselves as patriotic. Overall, perhaps because of that particular issue, and some of the college campus protests, freedom of speech polled the highest across the country in terms of how meaningful it is to of a list of things that sort of comprise patriotism. So we see freedom of speech really percolating to the top as what people associate with patriotism. But when it comes down to how people are defining it beyond that, we're seeing 30-point gaps between those who have a conservative political ideology and liberal in terms of how important these things are, as well as how they rank them. So some of the things that are more important to conservatives, for example, are the national anthem and the Pledge of Allegiance. We saw a 30-point gap between how important that was to conservatives and liberals. So those emblems of Americanism are very thought of differently.
Yeah. We have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to drill down a bit on this point, Ansarok, because it really speaks to how we can all be describing ourselves as patriots or patriotic, maybe not all, but the vast majority of us, and yet seem to have such very different sort of attitudes and, for that matter, conduct with respect to the country, the symbols of it, and what it stands for. That is going to be the subject of our next part of the conversation with Anne Sirach of the Frontier Lab and also the Ear to the Ground initiative. Stay tuned for more.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Our guest is Anne Sirach. She has just published a new product, in fact, unveiling a new initiative, of which it is the first product. It is the Ear to the Ground initiative, and its first research done in collaboration with a terrific public opinion researcher, Dr. George Barna, and his American Culture and Faith Institute, is about American views on patriotism. It was the subject of a press conference call that Anne and George and others had earlier in the day. We are speaking with her before it actually occurred, but after this broadcast afterwards, of course. And Anne, I just wanted to get your sense of how would you characterize the two patriotisms? I mean, what is it that most defines the differences between people? Is it the left versus the right, the conservatives versus the liberals, the elites versus the people? I mean, what is it that you find is best exemplified in the adhering to these different patriotisms?
Yeah, it really was for this survey. What this survey revealed is that the party lines really did reveal a fissure, as well as age group. But there were just such a difference in terms of urgency and intensity about the feeling. So one of the aspects we polled about was, do they feel that patriotism is dropping? And that's something where we saw, again, about a 30-point drop. So conservatives were far more likely to perceive that there was a drop in patriotism, so that perception is there. But then when they're defining it, we're looking at 65% of conservatives saying it's completely accurate to say they're proud of being American. 37% of liberals say that they are proud to be American. 18% of liberals would prefer to live in another country, which I thought was somewhat high. And then when we're looking at sort of the more drilling down into what it means to them, liberals were 20 points less likely to consider citizenship meaningful. They assessed a far lower value on all of the rights attached. Let's look at the right to bear arms was a 40-point difference, more than a 40-point difference. So we're looking at sort of a lower ranking in terms of meaning of all the traditional aspects of patriotism. That's freedom of speech, freedom of religion, citizenship, the U.S. Constitution, etc.
And one of the things that's jumping out at me is, as you discuss this, there is indeed, happily, a very profound indication that people in this country appreciate and support and want to be able to exercise free speech. But in a way, at least as I've come to experience this sentiment of late in some quarters, there are very important differences in terms of what is considered to be free speech. Free speech for some is any speech, and I think that's what the framers of the Constitution clearly had in mind. Indeed, arguably, the thing that was most protected was the part of speech that was likely to be deemed offensive to some, because otherwise it would be not allowed, it would be suppressed. And yet that's what increasingly it seems some who may, you know, as you've indicated, be patriotic, nonetheless are saying, well, we're for free speech, but not if it offends people, particularly moi, you know. So how does that kind of exemplify what you've been discerning in these differences between the one or the other school of patriotism you've identified?
Yeah, I think you really hit on it, because it's the definition. While we're actually seeing a pretty similar, when it comes to freedom of speech, as I said, that overall is polling as the most important aspect tested with both liberals and conservatives. It's that definition of what it means. So we're finding that, in fact, the only aspect of patriotism that those on the left deemed more important than conservatives did was the use of nonviolent civil disobedience to overcome what they call social injustice. So it's that term that, how are you defining freedom of speech? And I've done actually other research that shows that on the freedom of speech, it shows that that often is described by those on the left as actually a freedom from judgment. So when you're defining it in that way, you may think that you're talking about the same thing. And that's one of the results of this survey that we want to bring to more people, that even if you use a term as sort of innocuous sounding to us, or at least a definition you think you're all using, freedom of speech, it's quite clear that people aren't interpreting that in the same way.
And this point about, you know, freedom from discrimination, or however you want to characterize it, actually does involve a certain amount of discrimination, does it not? It essentially says you may not say things about people lest you be discriminating. And that, in a way, again, flies in the face of certainly the traditional understanding of freedom of speech. And I wonder if we're not now watching in other areas as well, either a calculated or simply the phenomenon of changes to the basic understanding of what we're talking about, whether it's patriotism or speech, or for that matter, citizenship. And I wanted to ask you about citizenship. This was another point on which there was a rather striking difference between the two patriotisms you've identified. Clearly, those who hold to what I would think of as a sort of more traditional view of American exceptionalism and love of country and so on have a very strong attachment, it seems, to citizenship. The others, with their revised definitions or what have you, not so much. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, Ansarach.
Yes. As I said, liberals are 20 points less likely to consider that and personally meaningful to them. And I think that this goes along with another data point we found, which is 18% of liberals saying that they would like to live in another country, which I had mentioned previously. There's a less of an association with our country as representing these values in a unique way. So when you're asking someone, are they patriotic, and they're not even associating America with being the defender of those values, you're seeing that wear away.
Lastly, Anne, let me ask you about the role of faith in all of this. One of the things that I think has been most dramatic in the changing character of our country in the past few decades has been the embrace of secularism, to some extent the eschewing of Judeo-Christian traditions and values. Is that a fixture in all of this? Does it figure into what we're confronting now in the way of people simply not having as much of an attachment to America and what it stands for?
I'm so glad you brought that up. I think that it figures in by not figuring in. And it was very striking because of a list of items, sort of, as I had said, that we were asking people to rank how much they associated them with patriotism and how meaningful they were. The Bible was almost at the tail end of this list in terms of being associated with patriotism and meaningful. And that's even among conservatives. So I wanted to, you know, point out that this is not liberals are bad, conservatives are good in terms of patriotism type of result that we're looking at here, even from the point of view of those of us who respect limited government and these freedoms in the Constitution. I think there are some concerns here. All across the board, Americans are not associating faith or that Judeo-Christian ethic with what makes America exceptional. And that should be a warning to all of us that our civics are not transmitting this.
Well, to the extent that they're being taught at all, you know, it makes all the more important, I guess, the launch of the new Museum of the Bible here in Washington, D.C. at this very moment. Ansarach, I wish you the very best for this new project. I hope that we can help support it along the trail at the Center for Security Policy, and I look forward to the further results, the reaction to this immediate study on American patriotism, and those that you have in the offing. How can people look at the product and learn more about your initiative?
Yes, thank you. And it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for giving attention to this work. And if they would like to go to www.eartotheground.us.
Eartotheground.us. Terrific. And you'll come back to us, I hope, very soon. In the meantime, keep up the good work. Next up, we'll speak with Kenneth Timmerman. He'll talk to us a little bit about our increasing vulnerability to terrorist attacks thanks to bad policies of the New York City government and state, and also Huma Abedin's Muslim engagement. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Kenneth Timmerman. He is the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, a role in which he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, if you please. He is the author of numerous best-selling books, including Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi. He is also an investigative reporter of some renown, nationally recognized for his work in that regard. He is always a welcome guest here. We're delighted to have him back. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Frank.
Something you wrote at The Hill recently, Ken, caught my eye. It made the point that I think can't be made often enough, that the attack in New York City, the most recent of the several attacks in New York City, for that matter, may have been made, if not more likely, certainly more inevitable, by virtue of decisions taken by the de Blasio administration, the mayor, now recently reelected, for that matter, mayor of New York City. Talk a little bit about what prompts that conclusion.
I'm sure our listeners recall watching de Blasio and Cuomo, the governor of New York, kind of shaking their heads, say, oh, this kind of thing, it's inevitable, it happens, New York's a big city, you just got to get used to terrorist attacks. Well, no, they were lucky this time because the guy didn't blow himself up. He created a fizzle bomb and not a real bomb, or detonated it prematurely. But luck is not a policy. They dismantled, and this is de Blasio and his police commissioner, Bill Bratton, they dismantled a very effective program set up at the NYPD to identify potential jihadis before they radicalized or were radicalized by imams. They were looking at mosques that had a pattern of behavior. They had written a 90-page, really a textbook, that's the only way you can describe it, a textbook about jihad and how individuals who had unremarkable backgrounds and have no particular predilection towards terrorism can get radicalized. And they went through this step by step, and they did it in a very methodical way, where they tested their conclusions against different cases to see if what they had discovered in their investigation actually worked.
This book was called Radicalization in the West, and it was a very important tool, you're right, not just for the NYPD, as you know, Ken Timmerman, but it really set the gold standard, it seems to me, for other police departments, as did its so-called demographics unit. And tell us what happened to these important contributions to the fight against the, well, I think of them as Sharia supremacists here in the United States.
Yes. Well, so for starters, the textbook, Radicalization of the West, was taken down from the NYPD website. It was removed from all training classes. And then they disbanded the so-called demographics unit, which conducted surveillance of mosques and other places where potential jihadis hung out. In other words, the NYPD lost all of its eyes and ears in the Muslim community. They had no more warning out there, no indicators and warning, as you would say in the intelligence business, of what might happen. So yes, it was pure dumb luck earlier this week when that terrorist blew himself up instead of killing dozens of people. Pure dumb luck, because the New York NYPD willfully blinded itself to the threat.
Well, the mayor, I think, deserves most of the credit for that, if credit is the right word. But I think the point you're making, Ken, is so critical here, and that is, to the extent that we are willfully blind or we are otherwise disarmed, particularly our first lines of defense against such threats, it is, to use an overused term, it is a time bomb. And it's not going to be, I'm afraid, the case that we'll be so lucky in the future. I had a conversation with Alex Marlowe at Breitbart Radio yesterday on this very subject, and some in the Sharia supremacist community are taking exception to my argument that we need to be shutting these kinds of operations down. Not the police, but the Sharia supremacist incubators. Meanwhile, there's a report from Judicial Watch that a woman you and I have talked about in the past and been worrying about for some time, Huma Abedin, The former deputy chief of staff of the Department of State under Hillary Clinton was allowed to walk out of the State Department when she and her boss left with five boxes full of documents, which I'm fairly certain have since been shredded, including apparently a file called the Muslim Engagement Papers. Ken Timmerman, what should we make of what Huma was up to and the possibility that we've lost insights into it?
Frank, I saw this report and I just kind of kicked myself. How is this possible that a government official, which she was Hillary Clinton's personal aide at the State Department, could be allowed to walk away with key documents from Mrs. Clinton's time, schedules, lists of gifts that she had received, and as you say, these so-called Muslim engagement documents. It's just unbelievable, and you wonder if there wasn't some kind of wink and a nod from people in the intelligence community who were willing to help Mrs. Clinton cover up what she had done.
Well, there does seem to be a lot of that going on at the moment, doesn't there, Ken? Which brings us to this this chap, Peter Strzok, an FBI agent who seems to have been a government employee in name only. He seems to have been pretty much full-time on the Hillary Clinton campaign or detail, at least. What's up with that and the deep state operation that he seems to have been part and parcel of in support of Hillary and seeking the defeat of Donald Trump as a candidate and subsequently, I think, his takedown as president?
Well, we've been learning about this from the congressional hearing this week and from investigative reporting at Fox News. There is an inspector general's investigation underway at the Department of Justice that uncovered Strzok's text messages, thousands of them, with his girlfriend, also an attorney at the also working at the FBI.
Girlfriend, let's just be precise. Mistress, apparently.
Mistress, an extramarital affair. They describe one meeting in the office of Andy McCabe before the election where she kind of laid out a scenario where Trump could not possibly win, and they talk about needing a fallback plan in case Trump, an insurance policy in case Trump might win. This is called conspiracy. And it's called conspiracy to undermine the duly elected president of the United States. I seem to remember that there are criminal charges surrounding that kind of activity.
There are penalties that are associated with that behavior. It remains to be seen whether any charges will be leveled. And just for the purposes of identification, Andrew McCabe, of course, is the number two in the FBI, even today, under President Trump, a man who has been implicated, I think, not only in this instance, but in others, with deep hostility to the President of the United States. It just is simply mind-boggling. Ken, let me turn quickly, in light of the work that you do at the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, which is an extraordinarily important work, let me add. The Iranian regime has apparently used some of the $150 billion that Barack Obama saw fit to give them to arm the Houthi rebels in Yemen, including, it now appears, with ballistic missiles of the kind that was recently launched against Riyadh Airport in Saudi Arabia. Nikki Haley, the ambassador to the United Nations, had a press conference a day or so ago in which she talked about the evidence that has now been collected from the pieces of that missile, that it was, in fact, Iranian supplied. What's the story here, Ken, and how serious a problem does it represent?
Well, she gave a pretty dramatic press briefing with a giant chunk of the fuselage of this missile that had been launched against the civilian airport in Riyadh from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, from Yemen, and with numbers on different parts of the missile to show that these parts were indisputably manufactured in Iran. The missile was manufactured in Iran, supplied by the Iranians to the Houthi rebels, and fired deliberately at Saudi Arabia and at the civilian airport. This is an act of war. It's also, as you mentioned, a violation of the UN Security Council resolution on Iran, which enshrined the terrible Iran deal into UN policies.
Or didn't, as the case may be. As a practical matter, it seems all nonsense, in fact, doesn't it? Ken, we have to leave it at that. I'm sorry to say there's just so much to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back on with us soon to do a full hour drill down, if we can, on all of the work that you're doing and the topics that need our attention. I appreciate the work you're about at the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, your investigative reporting and commentary, and, of course, your appearances with us. Bill Gertz joins us next. He'll take us inside the ring. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Bill Gertz, the man who gives us an inside look on what's going on inside the ring, the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. He is also the senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, an indispensable online resource. He is also the author of seven, count them, seven best-selling books, including most recently, iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's good to have you back as always. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Bill, you led your Inside the Ring column this week with a very troubling account of a study by the Rand Corporation indicating that the United States might not win the next war. I'm sorry to say that I fear many of these conclusions spring from the kind of information Dakota Wood at the Heritage Foundation shared with us recently about the appalling lack of readiness and modernization and training of our military, and therefore its preparedness to deal with the kinds of threats that are emerging now. We'll talk about those more in a minute, but give us a sense of this Rand study and how grim is the forecast.
Well, yeah, I was really surprised. This is Rand is a serious think tank which does a lot of government contracting work, and this is a study that was looking at the U.S. military's force structure, which has always been designed to fight two regional conflicts. And the study concluded that the structure that we have, the Army Combat Brigades, the Air Force Fighter Squadrons, the Navy's carrier strike groups, Marine Corps amphibious, are poorly structured, and so poorly structured for the current environment, which is the rise of China, especially in the Indo-Pacific, and Russia in Europe, that the conclusion was that they're so poorly structured that if there were a conflict, the U.S. would lose. And that is certainly a stark assessment, I think. I'm sure the Pentagon would take issue with it, and I was unable to get their comment on it, but it's certainly worth bringing up the debate about how the U.S. military is structured, and certainly Congress should also look at it.
Well, I think structure is part of it, Bill, and it seems to me that if you drill down further, you do get to some of these other issues that Dakota was talking about, which just exacerbate the problem, the lack of readiness and the degree to which we really have let our adversaries steal a march on us. In fact, you have a piece about how Russia is expanding its nuclear forces dramatically. And again, I don't know that most Americans are aware of this. I'm not even sure the president of the United States is, that they now seem to be poised to break out of their arms control agreements. Talk about what on earth that's about.
Yeah, this was an exclusive that I did for the Washington Free Beacon, which looked at basically what the U.S. intelligence community's assessment is, that by 2026, Russia is on track to have 8,000 warheads. Now, the New START Treaty, which was signed in 2010 by Russia and the United States, limits both sides to 1,550 strategic warheads. So where are the other thousands of warheads coming? Well, the Russians have figured out that low-yield and very low-yield nuclear weapons, which used to be called tactical nuclear weapons, when combined with precision-guided missiles, have almost the same impact as a large strategic warhead. So basically, the Russians are breaking out of the arms control constraints of the New START Treaty. They've already violated the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. So it's clear that the U.S. Has a big problem to face in nuclear deterrence. This is all part of a nuclear posture review, which is expected to be made public next month when the president gives his State of the Union speech.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that it mans up to this threat, which doesn't even take into account, in terms of what we've just discussed, at least, hopefully the NPR does, what the Chinese are doing in a similar vein. Bill, you also had an interesting piece about, and we've discussed this a little bit in the past, the Chinese use of what's now being called sharp power, not to be confused with soft power, including in the space that you've covered so brilliantly in your book, iWar, the information battle space. Give us a sense of how that complements and makes even more dangerous what the Chinese are doing in the old-fashioned military buildup as well.
Yeah, this was another Free Beacon story this week. The Congressional Executive Commission on China, which is one of the two congressional China commissions, held a hearing on Chinese influence operations. And this is a really important look at what the Chinese are doing around the world and in the United States. And it's a fairly alarming picture in the sense that the Chinese are literally buying up former government officials, they're buying up industries, they're using cash to influence the media. We've seen that in Hollywood. It's a full court press on the U.S. public opinion. And, you know, as I've written in iWar, the U.S. is largely unaware of this effort.
Let alone fighting back. Yeah. No, you know, it reminds me, Bill Gertz, you know so well, the book issued in 1999 by two People's Liberation Army colonels, Unrestricted Warfare. This is unrestricted information warfare, it certainly seems. And it's, I'm afraid, having an effect. Fortunately, at least so far, according to your reporting, Bill, Guo Wengui, an important defector from the communist apparatus and business community, has seemingly, the government here, the Trump administration, has spurned Chinese demands that he be deported. Is that right?
Yeah, this was based on a background briefing with a senior Justice Department official who said that the Attorney General has reviewed the case and doesn't see any grounds for extradition, which is a good thing because Guo, this dissident billionaire, has been the target of a massive Chinese influence operation, which has included hacking against U.S. institutions, against his lawyers, has used the use of businessmen to lobby as high up as the president himself. And so they've looked at that and they see that this is clearly not a legal matter, but a political case involving a dissident who is opposed to the regime. You mentioned fighting back against these. Now, the good news is I had a piece today and also in the Free Beacon, which previews the Trump administration's new national security strategy. One of the four pillars of that strategy is expanding American influence. It recognizes this huge gap that the U.S. is facing in information attacks from countries like China and like Russia and the Islamic State. And it's calling for the United States to develop those capabilities. I talked with someone in the White House and immediately was able to get them a copy of my book, iWar, which contains a number of really revolutionary proposals for fixing the shortcomings in the information sphere.
Well, I hope that they will be adopted as part of the implementation of this strategy, Bill Gertz. I don't know if you've seen the strategy just yet or whether, like the rest of us, you're going to have to wait until they issue it next week, I guess Monday, but we'll look forward to talking with you about its contents afterwards. The thing that I've been struck by, and I really appreciated your reporting on this at the Free Beacon today, Bill Gertz, is that it sounded an awful lot like candidate Trump's national security strategy. And I'm just regretful that we've seen the better part of a year lost when it seems as though there hasn't been much of a strategy at all, or if it has, it's not certainly been the one the president enunciated as a candidate. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this strategy is very important in that sense. This is the White House laying down markers for the agencies that, again, have been dominated by either Obama holdovers or bureaucrats who are resisting the president and his policies. So I think it's this strategy will be a little different than the most recent Obama strategy, which was pretty much boilerplate stuff that really didn't have a sense of returning and resetting American foreign policy. The idea of the strategy is that it will set the tone for the policies that will be developed so that the White House can go to the State Department, they can go to the Pentagon and say, here's what our strategy is. You develop policies that fit that strategy.
Yeah, well, let's hope they do. They may need to do some new management across the board to do that. But Bill Gertz, it is a heartening sign. We'll look forward to your analysis of it, as well as the chance to talk with you again next week. In the meantime, be well, my friend. I hope all of you will join us again next week as well. Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.